manager.
All right, should we get started?
Already.
Ray and Lee have asked me to chair this morning's commission meeting, which is fine. It looks like it was a good idea we call this as a formal meeting. Otherwise, we'd be in violation of the Brown Act. But in spite of the setting, in spite of the fact that it's an official meeting, we want to try to keep this as informal as possible. The idea today is to advance our understanding of what tools there are for financing infrastructure. We have the city's financial advisor here to assist us in that. And you've seen the copies of all the questions that commissioners have brought forward. And the idea is not to make this a real formal presentation. You'll have some opening remarks. But to have this as a dialogue and a conversation. And we'll see where it takes us. And what Joe has said to me, you know, if this doesn't meet all our needs, we can meet again. But I think this is a good start. I'm glad to see other commission members here besides the Finance Committee, because after all, we are one commission. So with that, let's get started.
Sure.
So, Bob,
you want us to talk about GFMA?
Yeah, did you want to make some introductions and just...
Well, this is Peter Miller and Bob Gamble. I'm going to introduce themselves, and they are new to the city of Palo Alto, although not completely new. Peter worked on the 1998 golf course COP to the city at one point earlier in his long career. We welcome them today. This is Bob Gamble, and Bob, they'll tell you about themselves, but that's it. We're very fortunate to have them, and look forward to working with them long-term, not only on this project, which is extremely important, but on refundings that we intend to do relatively soon for other debt, and move on to other projects as well over time. So here they are.
Good morning. Sorry, I'm a little late. Let's just talk about who Public Financial Management is. We were formed in 1975, home office in Philadelphia. We were sort of the response to the New York City debt crisis, in which at the time financial advisors were often underwriters, and the solution to every problem was to sell more bonds. We quite see that to the founders that was a reasonable solution to all problems. And so we're now the largest independent financial advisory firm in the country. We have about 470 people.
Can everybody hear okay?
Thank you.
Sorry.
Almost. We have a microphone.
Well, feel free to come up. Nobody needs to sit in the back of the class here. It reminds me of teacher.
We are we have offices throughout the country, including San Francisco. There are, I guess, 33 offices. We do all kinds of finance. We are a firm that does financial advisory work, which is what Bob and I do. We also do money management, investment management, asset management. We've got about $40 billion of almost all public funds that we advise on the investment of. We do other sort of provide other services to governmental entities as well. We only work with the public sector. Many of us were in the public sector, as Bob and I were. Many of us were clients in the past. I was a client. I was the debt issuer for San Francisco, and somewhere along the line hired PFM, and I've been at PFM now for this is my 20th year. So I've been doing public finance for around 30 years.
Another 30 years of experience here, roughly, in public finance. I had a fairly long career in the public sector in San Francisco as budget director of the city under Mayor Feinstein. I was also CFO of the Redevelopment Agency. I then had a sort of career tangent off into private philanthropy, where I ran a significant family fund for about 7 years in San Francisco. I've been with PFM about 7 years. I have a very broad practice. I cover a lot of cities, small, medium-sized cities up to San Francisco. I also work for a number of large public utilities districts. I work for some nonprofits, for some housing agencies. So I have a fairly broad experience in different kinds of organizations, different kinds of credits, and how they are approached in the credit markets. Also have significant focus on public-private partnerships. I've done a lot of sort of real estate-based public-private partnerships over the years. And my goal was to sort of bring this kind of range of experience to this context here and to try to make that base of knowledge work in this situation.
Well, what I'd like you to do is just get started on addressing some of the themes and some of the questions that we had as a committee. You know the charge of this committee, which is we know we've got a gap in infrastructure, and we're trying to identify that gap and prioritizing projects and then figuring out ways to finance them. So
sure.
In the broadest terms, as I understand it as a commissioner, that's the mission.
Okay.
And so today we're focusing on the financial piece.
Sure. No, I mean, we've had a chance to think about this a little bit, although it's been somewhat conceptual so far because we are very new. But I mean, first of all, your challenge is not unique at all. A lot of cities in California are facing this challenge, and frankly, a lot of them are not as well equipped to approach it as Palo Alto is. You have some unique characteristics here that it's certainly still a challenge, but you have some real assets here too that help you meet the challenge, I think. So, I mean, as you were describing, I think sort of the step in the process that, as I understand it, is already underway is the process of sort of prioritizing, you know, probably a very long list of projects that need to be addressed and a long list of infrastructure needs. I think that's a process that we can advise you on to some extent, but I think where our value added can begin to come into play is when you're looking at that list of projects, I think what you need to begin to think about, what we can begin to help you think about, are alternative financing approaches for different types of projects. And obviously there's a range of projects out there. Some may have potential revenue sources attached to them, some may not. Some may be able to access certain types of financing. So as you go through that list, the objective would be to begin to dovetail together different types of financing techniques to fit the needs of the projects. At the end of that process, you're probably going to come to still a core list of projects which don't have easy revenue sources, which don't have easy sort of methods of finance that you can attach to them. And then you begin to think about how do you leverage the city's basic balance sheet, its general fund balance sheet? How much bond capacity do you have, not just now, but over a longer period of time? I assume that you want to think about this as a 10 to 20 year CIP process. Yes?
Looking ahead, I see two needs that we will have. One is for long-term financing of specific discrete projects, classic bond financing. The other will be additional financing to maintain our infrastructure. And I'd like you to address that a little bit. What are their techniques, not for bond issues, unless we can issue bonds for maintenance, but how do we raise more money for maintenance of our existing infrastructure?
Yeah, well, to answer that question, you have to be more specific about what it is you're trying to maintain and what the nature of the asset is that you're maintaining. I mean, a classic example, I think, of that problem is street maintenance. Streets, and there's just, in every city I work with, there is this discussion about how to deal with streets. Streets have typically been not well maintained in most California cities for a fairly long time. There's substantial delayed maintenance that needs to be done. Yet, if you think about approaching the voters, for instance, with a GO bond, is it really fair to go to the voters and say, we want you to vote for a GO bond because we haven't been filling potholes for the last 30 years? So that, you know, that's a difficult area. On the other hand, to flip that on its head a little bit, streets are a long-term asset. They, if maintained properly, they last 20 to 30 years. So in that sense, it is appropriate to think about using, you know, a long-term debt instrument to support an asset that has a longer life. the question is, where do you draw the line between sort of routine maintenance, which you know, pretty clearly should be done on a pay-as-you-go basis. So that has to be integrated into your long-term financial plan as something that you build into your operating budget each year. How do you maintain a level of quality in the streets while at the same time doing that catch-up to get back to where you need to be in order to do that maintenance? So it's kind of a conceptual answer, but the question is a little conceptual too. I hope that's helpful.
GO is
general obligation.
Well, are there techniques for raising current income? In other words, what I'd love to do is raise the property tax. Given the fact that I can't raise the property tax, what concepts do you see available to us to go to the voters, or perhaps not go directly to the voters, to legitimately ask for funding to help our infrastructure?
Yeah, there's a few ways to do it. I mean, the direction of California law, as you probably well know, over the last 30 years has been to make it more difficult to do that sort of thing and to require votes in most cases, in many cases, two-thirds vote. So just to start with kind of the most simplistic one, you know, you can put in place a parcel tax, which can be used to support. And a partial tax is essentially requires a two-thirds vote is a method by which voters agree to tax themselves at a higher level than that which is set, you know, in Prop 13 for a fixed period of time to achieve a certain objective. So that's kind of like the most straightforward thing you can do. The other types of techniques that are out there beyond just sort of adding to the property tax itself, although some are versions of that too, are various kinds of community assessment districts, community facilities districts. Those mostly require a two-thirds vote as well. There are a few types of assessment districts that require a 50% vote, but those are, you know, not surprisingly, much less flexible. So, Peter, you want to throw in some other?
Those are pretty much sort of where they are. And then usually what you want to do is identify some signature asset of the city that that voters can identify with, that is, as I said, some signature of the city that, I mean, if it's park districts, there are certain cities in which, for example, this is different from here, but their school district, for example, is a chief asset of the city, that it's a very good school district, and so they have a series of parcel taxes to maintain, you know, the school district, and it helps keep property values up and those types of things. So
that's what we got right now.
Yeah.
But in essence, those are general revenue. You can say the money is for roads, but the city can go back out their regular road money. So in essence, you're raising general revenue. It doesn't matter if it's there for the streets.
Yeah, there's a trade. There's a kind of trade-off in the way California law is structured on taxing issues. You can pass a general tax of the city if it's just going into the general fund and it's not earmarked by a 50% vote, versus, you know, like a general sales tax or something like that. Then, as you say, it just goes into the general fund and it's subject to the annual budgetary process. If you want to pass a tax that's earmarked for a specific purpose or set of purposes, that requires a two-thirds vote.
But the earmarking doesn't work unless you have a maintenance of effort. The earmarking just says that money goes to the roads, but then they take the road money
out of the general fund
and spend it on the parks. So the state has that same thing. Unless there's a maintenance of effort required, which has to be very hard to enforce, it is in fact general revenue.
I think you can put a sort of maintenance effort language, you know, into a measure like that. But as you say, enforcing it, you know, can be difficult. But if that's important, if you put it in, at least you've got that.
Is there history there
for maintenance of effort provisions?
Well, is there history in your experience that the earmark taxes passed by cities and other districts in California actually went 100% added 100% to that purpose.
I think
most are getting, you know, passed down.
There are examples on both sides of the ledger, frankly. I was meeting yesterday with some people at they were concerned with the Recreation Park Department in the city of San Francisco. The city of San Francisco passed, you know, 30 years ago a measure essentially requiring a portion of the property tax to go to the Recreation and Park Department. But historically what's happened basically is they got that, but then their general fund allocation was reduced over time, so it became a zero-sum game for them. So they're very frustrated by that, not surprisingly. So that's one example. But on the other hand, I would say there are a lot of examples of it being successful, too, of you know, if you're trying to support a specific service that, you know, an earmarking can be successful and you can require a maintenance effort so the general fund is not reduced. But that's also, I mean, presumably for that to happen, there needs to be consensus about that happening, yeah, too, at the highest level of council.
Another way that some cities have done this is that they pass a parcel tax or something like that for, let's say, 5 years, and that it has to go back to the voters every 5 years. And so every 5 years they have to prove that all that money went to that effort and that effort hadn't been shortchanged in some other way. Now, that's also an incredible pain in the neck because you have to go back, and if 1 year it's denied, then you're sort of, you know, without those funds. But that is one way that the process has kind of kept the feet to the fire of those projects to make sure that as much as possible goes to those projects without it being shortchanged or something.
You said on the three things you made was a great example. You said on the one hand, you know, it's just regularly going to be in the general fund.
But it's potholes, yeah.
But I thought I heard you say that there was, since it's a long-lived asset, there was some way that you could include some kind of repairs in a GOR.
Total reconstruction.
Yeah, if you're rebuilding the street from the ground up, that's more than pothole filling. You're rebuilding the foundation of the street, the curbs, and all of that stuff. Then if you think about that, that's a long-term asset. So it's, you know, from a policy perspective and from a financial perspective, it's reasonable to pay for that over a period of time. But if you're just filling potholes on an annual basis, that's more of a pay-as-you-go type of expenditure.
Let's give Greg a shot there.
Sorry.
Well,
thank you for coming out this early. So I guess right now we're in kind of recession. It's probably one of the toughest recessions that a lot of people live in memory. So I think the appetite to raise taxes even more, especially if people fall off and pay a lot of taxes, right? It's not very high, right? You may not go, oh yeah, you can raise your taxes. So we both talk about that, we shouldn't fail. So
yeah, right.
5 years ago, that doesn't go very well.
Right.
And you mentioned a lot of public-private partnerships. Can you talk about ways to increase revenue without actually taxing people and making tax burden higher? Because I know people personally who have trouble making the mortgage.
Right.
Here's another $1,000 parcel tax.
Right. No, I'm glad you're asking. I wanted to get that on the table. I've done a lot of real estate-based public-private partnerships. So that means that the variety of different structures and ways to do that. But fundamentally, it means looking at public assets, but particularly real estate assets, and just trying to maximize the value of those. And trying to monetize the value of those assets into revenue streams that can support something. I mean, and sometimes, you know, it's more appropriate to put that into sort of capital reinvestment because it can be a one-time revenue source. But I don't know enough about Palo Alto yet to sort of know what's here and what could be used in that way. But I mean, obviously, Palo Alto, I mean, in some broad sense, is mostly a built-out city. You don't have, you know, substantial swaths of land that you could do something with, and they're probably not public ownership anyway. But to the extent that there may be, you know, smaller opportunities to do that on a spot basis, it's the kind of thing that's potentially worth looking at. Having said that, it's also fair to give a caution that those are often very, you know, sort of painful, confusing long-term processes with a lot of brain damage attached to them. You have to be prepared to sort of let that process play out. That doesn't say, does not say you shouldn't try to pursue it, because I think there is potential value there.
Thank you.
appreciate that. I'm like Greg, at some point, which we have a finance committee meeting in the future, it'd be nice to spend a little bit more time going in depth on the public-private partnership opportunities, because I think there are some real opportunities. But I think it's also helpful to give you some context about it. When we talk about the infrastructure gap that we have, it's really, at least the way I see it, three unique gaps. One is, and you touched on it already, which is the deferred maintenance, several years of deferred maintenance. And I don't think that's unique to tell.
No.
Pretty much every municipality tries to do that. So that's one. I think the second one is there's always a desire in Palo Alto to add to the asset base to achieve some kind of goal or objective. We're dealing with it with a number of different projects. The third one, I think it's one of the ones we're really challenged with, is for all those new incremental capital projects, I think there's the way the current system works is that there's a short-term approach to how do we finance the capital, but really not a lot of forethought to how do we maintain it over the next 30 years. Right? And so if we were to use, it's often done by private commercial homeowners associations, which are required by law to reserve every year over the life of the asset. A big question is how do we fund that? Because what ends up happening is we pass the library
for 20 years and you have a big problem.
Well, we pass the library bond, but then Lalo and his team have to go and figure out where are we going to pay to maintain this thing over the next 3 years out of the existing general fund. And so it would be really helpful to understand from you, have there been creative ways that people figure out how to finance those incremental O&M costs?
It's really interesting. I think Peter would have a similar view of this, but if you look at what's happened in California over the last 30 years, when Prop 13 passed, because of the way it capped revenue growth, it created an immediate issue of that kind, and it's grown since 1978 when that passed. Whenever GO bonds have been passed to increase the size of infrastructure, there's been insufficient revenue growth to cover that. The way it's been dealt with in a lot of places, first of all, it's a problem. I mean, it hasn't really been addressed fully. But the interesting technique that's been used to address that in some communities are these so-called community facilities districts, the Mello-Roos districts. Because when you pass a Mello-Roos district, you can cover both the capital expenditure out of it, and you can set aside a portion of the revenue stream to also cover maintenance and operating costs. And so, especially if you look at more suburban types of cities, typical kinds of cities in the Central Valley and the areas that have been through these fairly massive expansions over the last 30 years, that's basically how they've done it. They've created both the capital from the Mello-Roos districts, which is an add-on tax, by the way. It's an increase in the property tax. And then they set aside a portion of that to essentially increase the operating budget by a sufficient amount to cover those kinds of things. And that does work. I mean, you can do that. It is a real tax increase, though, and you're putting that in place over a long period of time. But it is, both a recognition of that problem and a way of dealing with it. It doesn't fit every solution going forward, because if you've already got the problem, passing Mello-Roos retroactively in a place like Palo Alto could be a very challenging thing to do. But it is a way to do it.
And what drives Mello-Roos? Is it parcel-based? Or
it is.
So it's like a parcel tax, in a sense.
It is like, but it has more flexibility on how you structure the tax itself. You can adjust the tax by size of parcel, not necessarily value of parcel. You could do the amount of frontage it has to a particular street. You can have the size of the building on it, but it doesn't or not include the building. You have a lot of flexibility, so long as it's consistent, fair, and is not based on assessed value. So those are the only restrictions. But just one other thing, just before we leave this, is that the other restriction on the maintenance portion of a CFD is that it can only be used for new facilities. So
you can't backfill against your own.
Right. So if you're building something new, you can maintain that, whether it's a new street. No, you can't do streets with no roofs, but a fire station, let's say. You can maintain the fire station going forward. You can pay for new police services in a new area, but you can't pay for services that are currently existing because they don't want the substitution issue.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But I think that's reasonable if presumably you're able to meet the obligation existing O&M out of your existing general fund, arguably you're marking those funds for the new project.
Right. So you get this interesting situation where in times like now you have an area whose services, let's say police or fire, are being paid for, maintained out of Belarus, and that money continues to be there while the rest of the services are being suffering. Are going down because of the stress of the general fund.
Could you speak down the flexibilities and availabilities currently of non-bond financings, as that is bank loans, private placements? Is there any market that the cities are taking opportunity to fund with or not?
For capital or for maintenance?
Either.
Now, I have not heard of any being used for maintenance. But I have heard for capital improvements. There are some banks that are actually have these programs, Wells Fargo, where they actually buy the bonds. And you can have either fixed or floating rate bonds that the bank will just purchase.
But it's a bond issue first, and then
It's a form of a loan.
It's a private placement, essentially, with a bank. Yeah.
But a private placement requires a public vote.
The issue for a vote is the obligation to repay beyond a year. And so if you have an instrument in which 5 years, 2 years, 20 years, if in California, short of a lease, except if it's a lease, a capital lease, you're going to need some form of a vote. If it's a capital lease, because it means that you have an asset like City Hall, which you've leveraged, is being used to... you use this as the excuse to pay some debt service on other bonds, that does not require a vote.
Brent, do you have a question?
Yeah. Do you guys know the Belarus history? What is the redevelopment agency down and the loss of revenue that they're going to see? Is that the incremental amount of money that is provided to the Belarus district also potentially?
That hasn't been a threat from the state so far. That their focus is just on redevelopment at this point.
It is potential.
I honestly haven't heard any discussion of it at all. So I don't think that's a real threat.
Question.
Are any cities?
Yeah, I think that is something. I mean, if you have a real estate asset that is susceptible to that sort of an arrangement, and that's a way of capturing the value in an asset that we talked about earlier in the public-private partnership. If you have an asset that is just sitting there and you can capture some revenue from it, potentially then you could lease back a portion of the space or all of the space, and there can be added value in those. But it just depends on the value of the asset.
Ray, thank you for your time.
I'd like to ask two questions. One on what you just said. Is sale leaseback a positive, affirming method, or is it a desperation method? Since you lose control of future costs on the asset because now it's owned by somebody else and they can charge you what you want, are there positive, affirmative ways of looking at that voters could assess and say, gee, that seems like a good idea, rather rather than, oh my God, what is this town come to? They're selling City Hall.
Yeah, well, the state was a good example that it seemed like a sham to sell those assets.
Yeah, it certainly didn't feel like a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it this sort of engages a larger question about public-private partnerships. You know, the European model of public-private partnerships, public assets are sold. Meeting. So and they're sold for, just to be they monetize the value, they sell them, that you've said anything, and then those are passed essentially almost completely to the control of private entities. That model hasn't really caught on in the United States for the kind of reasons you're talking about. So there's a real tension there that exists, and there are certainly cases in the United States where those arrangements have proven to be successful so far, but if you look at it over the longer haul, over the longer term, it's still, you know, sort of an open question as to how that works out over the longer run. I mean, in general, the kinds of places where it's been successful, obviously, are large transportation projects. But there's still real nervousness in a lot of communities about the sale of public assets, and you know that's kind of a fundamental political tension that, you know, we can't solve for you.
My second question, I want to change the subject to sex. We have discovered that infrastructure is not the sexiest topic around. And a few years back, we had two competing needs. One was for a library, and one was for a public safety building. And the city polled the voters as to what do you like. Both of them got very substantial positive responses, with the library beat the two-thirds, just on an opinion poll, and the public safety building didn't. I forget what it got high 50s or low 60s in terms of appeal. So, and the case was, I think, very well made, but it's a public safety building, it's not a library. If you don't want to go to a public safety building, you do want to go to a library. What experience do you have, and how do you make infrastructure assets sexier so that the public begins to respond to them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think particularly the example you picked, because in a lot of the communities that I've worked in, certainly in San Francisco, public safety gets everything they want. I mean, if the fire department goes to that community and says, we want gold-plated valves on our fire hydrants, they get them. So, I mean, you know, to answer the question bluntly, I think fear comes into play. I mean, you know, if the public's officially scared by the possible failure of infrastructure, that's one reason they vote for it. I think the flip side of it is what you're talking about with the libraries. If it's something they love and they believe in and it's kind of close to their heart, and they don't have to be afraid of libraries failing, but they love them. Or, you know, recreation centers do very well in some communities because that's such, you know, an integral part of the core values of those communities.
So we should raise the crime rate.
you just need some credible threat here, you know. I mean, earthquake always does it in San Francisco.
How are other cities coping with the fact that internet purchases are bypassing public sales tax?
I think so far that's been a state issue, not a local issue. So far, states seem to be struggling with federal law restrictions about that. I haven't really heard of cities attempting to apply the sales tax to internet purchases so far. I just haven't heard
of it. San Francisco had a measure on the ballot that, among other things, would have required hotels and calculating the hotel tax to use the sort of the non-discounted, non-internet rates for the basis of their tax calculation. And I think that measure may have ended up being litigated. You know, it was a sufficiently legally murky area that I think even though it passed, it was not put into effect. So it's a murky area of the law.
Also, the reality is that Amazon is fighting that state by state. threatening states would remove all of its business functions from states if they tried to tax internet sales. They've been very, very active.
And the Congress is not interested in taxing those sales.
Right.
This is just a couple of things for a minute. This is a really big issue, and Peter's right. This is not contested at a local level. Even the states are unsuccessful. The states are really active. And there was an effort in former commission, maybe Stephen knows about it, to begin to talk about this whole issue of sales tax across the nation, how to deal with it, because there are huge administrative difficulties with it as well. So this is something that's been on the back burner for a while now, but there hasn't been a whole lot of success with it.
Steve, go ahead. Look at these guys.
We get you guys in here struggling. Ask you for all sorts of clever ways to hide the feet. So I'm going to try and clarify this a bit. So, so when you sell an asset, you raise questions of desperation, or like the state sold its cigarette revenue.
Steve, can you point here and talk to your mind?
Sure. When you sell an asset, whether it's the state monetizing its Indian gaming revenue or its tobacco revenue or selling City Hall or Chicago selling the parking meters, you're trading cash up front for either the loss of revenue downstream or an ongoing expense, which most likely the city has no blinking way of knowing that they're covering it. So isn't that the essence of the transaction? You're taking the money up front and having an annual diminution in revenues down the road.
Yes. There's different ways to structure these in terms of how much you get up front and then it's possible to get participation fees over time, but overall what you're doing is you're, as you say, monetizing the overall stream and getting something today, usually at a present value that has certain sort of assumptions.
The second example is my understanding of public-private partnerships. I didn't quite understand what real estate thing. I thought you were going to say, have a private person build a lease building and then lease it back. Sell your parking things. What you're doing there, as I understand it, the private sector may be able to raise the capital if you can't, they may have their project management if you can't, but what the citizens are doing, instead of paying taxes, they're paying fees. They're paying the parking money to the private operator instead of it going into the city revenue. If the private person built the library or the police department, we could pay lease revenue to them. We're paying annual fee revenue instead of floating them on and paying tax revenue, but it's not free.
Nothing's free.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
A public-private partnership is a way to raise capital where you pay for it over time in fees because the private guys have to make a return.
Yeah, but you're right.
And it is a... When doing the analysis between the public sector doing the project and the private sector doing the project and then selling it or leasing it to the public sector, the tension, of course, is the economy of the private sector doing it and managing it theoretically better versus the public sector being able to borrow it at a tax-exempt rate and versus the taxable rate of the private sector. And certainly it is a case by case because some places are just better at building projects than other places. Typically, public sector, much of public sector is pretty good at managing construction projects. And between that and being able to borrow the tax exempt rate, it's often difficult for the private sector to beat that.
Just to be continually grumpy, what's called better private sector management is that they're paying lower wages. They don't have to pay city wages. There may be some efficiency. I'm all for the private sector efficiency. But when they run the prison or they run the cafeteria or they run the parking lot, they're not paying city wages. They're paying private wages. We call that efficiency. You can call it efficiency if you want.
And to raise another...
Certainly it depends.
Yeah,
it's hard to generalize. There are instances in which private sector certainly does things better, more efficiently.
I'm worried about going out and telling somebody we have some miracle thing and it's free because we hire these really smart guys and they've got a way for you to avoid paying for it.
We agree with that.
And I'm sure you agree with that.
Bob?
Yeah. I have a question which is a little different area, which is kind of forecasting the infrastructure needs. And I kind of describe a little bit what where I think we are. So the City Council forms a commission to address medical on infrastructure projects and would like to work in your funding. And say, okay, how do we build it? And then, as we're unfolding our knowledge of how it works, what we see is that the city staff puts together a budget that covers how much, I'll get the numbers exactly right, let's say about a 3 to 5 year period. And the comprehensive plan covers a longer period, 10 to 12 years. And then the city council informs us that planning horizon for the city is actually 25 years. And when we look at the ongoing maintenance needs and the future needs of the city, going out 25 years is kind of hard to guess what's going to happen. But I guess my question is, particularly when every once in a while we need to replace a roof on a building, or the beach can seemingly need to be updated, and those aren't necessarily included on ongoing maintenance because they're 7 years, or 10 years. So I guess my question is, are there any...
and those are the sex problem that was mentioned before.
Yes, that's the land. So is there any guidance that you can give us from other communities or other public entities that help address what is the future view today of our infrastructure needs?
If you think back 25 years ago, it'd be hard, there weren't very many people who could predict where the world is today in terms of technology, in terms of the recent recession and all that. And so typically what happens is that the further out, the closer you are, the more specific you are, and the further out you go, the murkier and the more general the direction is. And you have then a process to update that in a reasonable periodic fashion to put more light and more specificity to those general trends and areas where you want to go. But it's awfully tough to predict where you're going to be 25 years from now, given 25 years ago. I mean, would we really know where we are today, and both how fantastic things are and how much more challenging they are? Right?
May I make a comment on Nancy Naylor, the nasty joke for Joe Mullen? 100 years ago, when I went to business school, they were a bunch of real estate lessons. There's don't these guys who private real estate just have these models where they have some kind of factor they assume for maintenance over time. I mean, this is not a new thing. We're inventing. There's just practice for this. And replacing the HAC every 7 years, like that's part of what you put, you have that in your maintenance budget. You save up for it. I mean, isn't that...
I do think it's true that not many cities do it, but I think that would be considered sort of a best practice, and it's just to the city literally to budget, an amount for pay-as-you-go kinds of maintenance, particularly in that sort of in-between area, I think, of, 5 to 10 years types of maintenance is needed in those, because it's not really that efficient to sell debt for those things. So I think that would be the best approach to it. Having said that, not many people do it.
That's one of the best practices. In your peregrine nations around the state of California. Who does it best?
Or who does it well?
Or maybe I should rephrase that.
There's a lot of pathology out there.
Who does it least worst? That is to say, who should we go to and talk to learn?
There must be somebody.
Yeah, we're gonna have to get back here. I mean, everybody is complaining about these issues now.
I would come back to the historical context of, you know, in Palo Alto may be as good as any, but you know, in post Prop 13 California, which is everything since 1978, it's getting to be a long time now. Everybody has this problem. I mean, to the extent you can, everybody has been doing increasingly triage on these kinds of issues, and it just gets worse over time. And you know, occasionally, I mean, last year there were discussions about attempts at the state level to sort of try to address the whole relationship between state and local government. I mean, that is followed by the wayside in the wake of, you know, our current budget crisis. But at some point, you know, that's a large policy issue that you have to assume has to get addressed somehow. And, until you do that, I mean, everyone is just doing triage.
One of the best managed cities I know of is the city of Roseville, up beyond Sacramento. But again, as Bob was mentioning before, Roseville has been a city for a long, long time. The fact that it's really grown in the last 20 years, so it is new from that perspective, and almost all of development is a result of some form of a Melrose special tax district, and so it has that maintenance built into it, and this has been going on for 20 years. And so they run the city very well. And plus they've got these other sort of built-in other revenue sources that have been there in some cases for many years. And so they're able to maintain their parks and their quality of life and their streets, even though streets can't be maintained by the Melrose districts, as well as anyone I've seen. That's just something off the top of my head. But that's a very well-run
city. That's good to do, sir.
Exactly. It does help.
They also they own their own electric utility. There's a similarity there with Palo Alto. I don't know if they own
wastewater as well.
And wastewater as well.
Yeah.
And that sort of a perfect segue into, I guess, one of the areas that I see many cities that are required to do is updating their general plan. And then as part of that process, many communities, and I think the Greg mentioned this at one point earlier, they look at areas where higher or intensification of use, often a higher upzoning session. And in such a case, and I guess it's a two-point question, it seems as that might be the city's only opportunity to implement a Melrose district, because there would be the potential to capture new revenues or not anticipate. And I was also curious about the maintenance of effort. I've seen them the vagaries of just the council's sort of strategic planning has gone into the reserve fund. Can that be, if a bond were issued, a maintenance of effort provision, ensure that there's a consistent flow in the infrastructure? So I guess those are the two.
I haven't seen the maintenance
of effort. No, I haven't either. I mean, I've seen it on partial taxes, I think, but I haven't seen it on a bond issue, per se.
Does that mean it's not possible to do?
No, I don't think so. No. But when you say...
I mean, a bond issue isn't going to get you maintenance, right? It's just going to get... I mean, and if you do a bond issue, you say, I'm going to build this building, and I'm going to build it for $10, right?
But could you say, this bond... even if it passes, if you don't pass an associated parcel tax or whatever it is that would pay for the ongoing maintenance, the bond is void.
I haven't seen that, but I don't see why you couldn't.
Yeah, I think you could potentially wrap those together into a single measure. I'm not sure you have to do it in a separate measure.
Or even more creatively, could you say we could estimate the long-term annual operating and maintenance costs is? What is the, in perpetuity, what's the discounted present value of that, and have a single bond measure that captures the present value of the perpetual?
You can't put the bond money sort of into an endowment, so to speak. That's against federal tax law.
Then it would have to be taxable. Not taxable. You could do it, but it would be taxable. The federal government doesn't want to subsidize that.
With all due respect to our new financial advisors, I tend to be very conservative about these things. This is a matter that we need to be opined upon by a bond council in terms of how you can use the monies, because they're the person who ultimately has to sign a letter along with the city attorney about how bond money can be used. I'm just letting you know about that.
Yeah, and if I could just interrupt for one quick second. As I understand it, we've got your services here till 9 o'clock.
Correct? Yes.
And my intention as chair today is to stop the meeting at 9 o'clock unless we all decide we want to go further. And we will allow some time. There is public. We'll allow some time for public comment, which we're required to do in a public meeting. So let's just continue the discussion.
Could you talk some about the current market tendencies or urgencies, and whether your activity level is up, whether municipalities are concerned about getting whatever they can get now at low rates and avoid inflation pressures later? Is there going to be more people pressing to do it, and therefore you should do it earlier rather than later?
In terms of financing projects.
Any funding for any purpose whatsoever?
Generally speaking, 2010 was one of the busiest years for municipal bond issues ever. It was a $430 billion year for two reasons. One, because interest rates were incredibly low, still in the depths of the recession. Number two, because of the BABS program. It's a very attractive program.
It's the federal stimulus bill.
Build America bonds.
Right, the Build America bonds. And it allowed municipalities to borrow money at extraordinarily low rates. So you're talking about 30-year borrowings for around 4%, sometimes 380, just very low. And so many municipalities, many public issuers, did what was reasonable, and they took advantage of both the very low rates and the ability to sell Build America bonds. Many of them pre-funded projects that they may have funded in 2011 or in 2013. Federal tax law requires, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't play on the television, you are supposed to, when you sell a bond issue, say that you will spend at least 85% of the project funds within 3 years of the close. And so many issuers would have no problem pre-selling in 2010, knowing that they could probably use all of it within 3 years of that time. So you had a tremendous number of issuers selling bonds in 2010 because rates were so low and because of the structure of Build America bonds. That 2011, there's very little being sold. We're down about 60% from where we were last year. And this is going to be one of the lowest, so far, the way this looks, the lowest times, the fewest amount of bond issues sold in a very long time.
And equivalent product, whether it was 4% or 3.8% last year, is 4.25% or 5% this year?
It's about probably in the 5.25% to 5.5% range. So you're up over 100 basis points.
A couple of other, it's a dangerous question, I guess, financial advisors, because we can pontificate for a long time on these things. But the other two things I want to mention is the fact that issuance is down means that it's actually a good time to issue because it's a good supply-demand situation, I think particularly for high-rated issuers. So that's one point. The other point I want to make is sort of a more broad historic point, which is that 3 years ago, the muni bond market was a pretty sleepy place. There were a lot of so-called intermediaries, insurance companies that essentially homogenized the credit for bond buyers. Bond buyers didn't do a lot of due diligence on what they were buying. And like what happened with the rest of the financial markets, that changed really dramatically. And so now the insurance companies are gone. They went bankrupt because of their mortgage-backed security investments. And so now the bond-buying public, which are largely people like you, are doing a lot of due diligence on the bonds they buy. And they want to know what they're buying. And they do a lot of investigation themselves. They are amalgamated into various funds, of course, at very large levels by some of the large fund buyers. But also there are, you know, varieties of subgroupings that drive the muni bond market. And so the point is, it's not at all a homogenized market now. It's a very detailed market where every seller and every buyer of bonds is carefully having conversations with each other about what they're buying and selling. And that's a big change.
And so the spread, so before, everyone was, since all bond issues were insured, and many of them were, everyone was buying the credit of the insurer, and so the difference in interest rates between the AAA and the BBB was very small, and now it's hundreds of basis points.
And if the bond rate levels of the equivalents we're talking about here is 5.25 now, how does that compare with private placement or bank funding?
Those are typically higher.
By 80 basis points, 150 basis points?
It depends on the project. It depends on the credit quality.
If you're talking about just a bank loan where the bank doesn't care whether it's taxable or tax-exempt, so they're essentially lending at a taxable rate, then I think the rule of thumb is it's about 180 basis points higher across the board. But some of those private placements are actually tax-exempt, in which case the spread's much smaller.
John?
City of Palo Alto's last bond issue was for libraries. We got the voters to approve a library bond which covered three different library projects, but they were all library projects.
There's a community center in there, too.
Huh?
Community center in there, too.
Yeah, true. Community center. I keep forgetting. I don't know what the key infrastructure projects, major building projects that we are likely to have to address, but Ray's already mentioned the public safety building is likely one. A rebuild of the Municipal Services Center might also be a project that needs to be undertaken in the near future. There's been some discussion of a couple of fire stations that are worn out and probably need to be rebuilt or new ones built to replace them. So they aren't common projects. They're all city projects, but they aren't a common purpose. Can we put on the ballot a multi-project bond issue that says, we want the voters to authorize a certain amount of bonds, which will be probably sold in separate tranches for separate projects, but just have one election that approves a whole bunch of different projects in one bond election?
Well, we're not bond lawyers, as was mentioned. Yeah. I think each bond, each proposition.
Do that. Let me ask it that way.
Each proposition has to be for a single type of project. So you can do fire stations on one ballot proposition. You could do parks on another, but you can't have a general approval of general obligation bonds for all types of multi-use kind of projects. Hmm. And again, that's for bond council, but that's always been drummed into my head.
But I've been here since 1981, and it seems to me that during that period of time, of 30 years, there was something at this county level, a sales tax, something or other, and it was accompanied by a list of very specific projects that would be undertaken if the increase in the sales tax was approved by voters.
Santa Clara County did 5 years ago, 8 different buildings, one for each district. It's a crime lab, 3 health centers, courthouse.
Those are for sales tax. I was thinking general obligation. Those were sales tax.
They were back with sales tax. It wasn't a pro. It wasn't a pro. It wasn't an addition to property tax. It wasn't an ad valorem tax. But the structure of it was different. It said we're going to increase sales tax by whatever it was, 0.5% to do the following things. That's different than saying we're going to increase the property tax to fund those things. So they, you know, they're structured a little differently, even though they sound the same.
That was also a strategy done very purposefully to get around the 2/3 vote requirement, that it was a general sales tax that required a 50% approval, and then the company projects sort of, it was a separate vote, but it got around, because if they put the projects in the ballot measure for the sales tax, it would have required, because they were for specific projects, would have required a 2/3 vote. So that was the strategy that was employed on purpose to do that.
So even if the scope of work is defined for the voters on a general obligation bond issue, like according to the way John was describing it, your understanding is we still couldn't have a vote because they're on totally separate projects. So if it's a police building, a fire, whatever, community center, if it's defined like that in the ballot measure, we had a general obligation. You're definitely under, well, you're under the...
I mean, we'll talk to Joseph Hall about it.
Okay, we'll talk. Okay.
But that is... Bob and I, when we were in San Francisco City Hall, we had our same sort of attorney who was the public finance attorney in the public in the city attorney's office, and he would pound on both of us to understand that you could only, you know, each general bond issue proposition has to be for a single purpose. So you could have so we would have, for example, in 1 year in San Francisco, we had a police station, fire station, park. You know, each one had to have a separate vote because they were for the same type of project.
I just to elaborate a little further, I think there have been efforts to wrap together different pieces of infrastructure under sort of a common purpose of, for instance, a public, sometimes it's geographic, if a particular part of a city is being developed, then there may be an effort to put a police station and some other, you know, kinds of related facilities in the area. So,
On a geo,
yes. I've seen, you know, attempts to sort of wrap this together under a broad purpose.
And if that was San
Francisco, it's something that bond council would have to rely on.
If that was San Francisco, maybe it had something to do with the nuances of San Francisco politics.
It definitely does, yes.
And their charter, you know, may say some things that are different than...
It's also, in that context, often a matter of strategy as to, well, we want to put this thing in the bond measure because we don't have another way to support it. We know we got a police station. We know people will vote for that. So we're going to put this other thing in there. And if bond council is okay with it, then we're going to put it on. And that's the way we're going to create support for that.
Okay, let's see. We got a few more questions because we do want to give the public. But we want to answer all our questions the best we can. So far, we don't have a comparable city to look at. Let's see. Ray and then our other co-chair.
As I understand, certificates of participation, they can be issued by the city council, but they are issued only if they have a claim against the general fund. I'm wondering if certificates of participation could be issued if they have a claim of a specific tax. So if we were to have a parcel tax or a sales tax and said the revenue from that is dedicated to repay certificates of participation, would that float?
Sure, you can have COPs for secured by water revenues, for a water revenue enterprise, for example. So
it doesn't have to be just against the general funds of the city. It can be
correct.
Especially designated.
Correct. And then what you'd have to do is look at that revenue source and see what kind of coverage there is. So if you need $10 a year, is there at least $15 a year coming in, which means that there's some cushion in case, you know, the revenue goes up and down, so you have to do analysis on that.
I think that
we
with Proposition 13, the general perception is that residential property is raising a greater percentage of the total tax revenue supporting the city, and that business property is raising a lower percentage. First of all, is that general perception accurate?
Yes. I haven't seen empirical studies of it. I mean, that is something that is sort of stated in a lot of other places. You hear in San Francisco all the time. That's the justification for why.
So we have to check out to see whether in fact that is true. But if it's true, and residents have been paying more of the cost of city government, is there a tax that we could recommend that would more equalize that and have businesses pay more?
Well, there are a variety of forms of business tax that cities have used in California. They, San Francisco has had several different versions of business taxes over the last 30 years. They currently have a payroll tax, payroll-based tax. It's a very substantial part of that city's general fund revenues. It is greatly hated by the business community, and not a year goes by when there isn't some effort to revise it. There are a variety of ways to tax businesses legally that have been established since Prop 13, and you just have to deal with the policy implications.
And they all require a two-thirds vote?
I think if it's a general tax, it's only a 50% vote, as long as you're not earmarking it for a specific purpose, it's a 50% vote.
So I know this morning's discussion has been around raising taxes, which is, I think this day and age is very difficult. I was wondering if you could get back to you mentioned private partnerships. Maybe what else could you see? I think Brent, I'll let you left. Can you talk a little bit about transfer development rights? Maybe perhaps monetize that somehow. There's, of course, trying to increase your sales tax base by having more sales generating properties. There's hotel development, good property tax. Can you talk a bit more about more creative ways of generating some of this finance without actually, hitting people who are already pretty hit up on taxes?
Well, I mean, you just gave a pretty good starting list there, I think, of some different ways to do it. The way that is. The method that's been most commonly used in California are various methods of redevelopment, which really means rebuilding a portion of the city to expand the tax base. I know it a little bit, but not super well. But it doesn't appear that you don't have a redevelopment agency, which may not matter anyway, since the government's trying to get rid of them. You also don't seem to have substantial undeveloped areas that you could develop more intensely. I mean, someone mentioned upzoning a little bit earlier. I mean, to the extent that you create more density in the city, you do expand the tax base without expanding, the square acreage of the city. So, I mean, that is a long-term kind of strategy that has other kinds of costs and policy implications that have to be addressed.
I guess, what about selling off transfer development rights? We review the project. Project where we were considering having them buy TDRs in the market.
Right.
And perhaps, that's one way to monetize.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those same values of all the world to be high.
Right.
So rather than asking, for more taxes, to sell off TDRs.
Absolutely. No, I think all of those things, I mean, they may seem to be small in and of themselves, but it doesn't mean that it isn't something that's worth addressing. And again, over a longer period of time, it is a way of trying to grow the tax base.
I don't know if you know, on the Charleston, San Antonio corner, across from JCC, that's actually Palo Alto, right across from JCC. And it's, if you walk around there, and I have, we have a concept plan area for that, it's a lot of big, big property on the corner.
Yeah.
And you see for sale signs everywhere, and it's kind of neglected, part of Palo Alto development. opens up, you know, unexploited assets for the bank. Wow.
Who owns it?
It's a bunch of people.
That's okay, it's in multiple private ownership.
And it's right next to downtown Big Box.
Right.
You have all the lots there, and you have our property, a hall, which is largely vacant and, you know, kind of disrepair.
Right.
We have a concept plan on it, and so, you know, it needs revenue.
Well, I mean, the classic approach to something like that is, I mean, if there's a way to consolidate the parcels or to encourage consolidation of parcels, and as part of the planning process, if you're able to allow something to be developed there of sufficient, you know, size and density to you know, substantially grow the tax base, absolutely.
It's not very residential. It's, you know, it's, most people think it's Malibu, actually. Uh-huh. It's on the other side of San Antonio.
Right. So, I mean, if you were able to do, you know, retail there, then you would get both the benefit of growth in property taxes plus some sales tax. So, I mean, this is an area where, obviously, you know, the trick here is integrating your sort of physical planning process, which you're involved in, and your financial planning process. So, I mean, I think those are great things to address, and they are kind of long-term approaches to growing the tax base without increasing taxes.
See, how many more questions we have? A few more. Steve's got one or a comment. Okay. A couple more. Go, Steve, you had something.
What's the general nature of their working relationship with you in terms of the operating budget versus
transfer financing? Generally, the financial advisor, but totally completely advises us on debt, financial, long-term financial analysis, sort of, but on the operating side, they do not. On the operating side.
And the question for you is the same one we went before. How would you make a connection between general fund revenue-raising measures that we talked about and maintaining roads or building a public safety building or improving public facilities? How just strikes me the general fund revenues.
Some of them ultimately will be, and that's why, I mean, even though, as Joe said, we're not in sort of a year-to-year involved in the budget process, there's a long-term financial planning issue that's engaged by that, I think. And so over a 10-year period, you're trying to invest in roads and other projects.
I may have taken your question too literally. I would think one of the functions of the financial advisor is definitely to advise us, as they have answered questions tonight on the maintenance that you're so concerned about. But, you know, I think there are certain practical limitations in terms of what bonds, for instance, can do. But I mean, they would offer us advice, hopefully on both sides, to evaluate the pros and cons. I may have taken your question.
Go ahead.
Several years ago, there were a lot of federal grants available for public safety, fire, those kinds of buildings that had come to cities. Or do you know if that program is going to be
I'm not aware of those programs generating any capital for cities recently.
Well, San Jose is a huge city.
With federal money.
Right. And several fires.
Right. Seems that the sentiment of Congress these days is against, going sort of against that trend. And so there aren't those programs today. It'd be hard to think that it would get through the House of Representatives.
All right, if I might, this discussion is carried on for more than an hour. I'm not sure whether we've shed light or heat on our mission. I mean, I think it's a very valuable discussion. I guess it's important here. Well, is there a comparable city? And we're waiting for that Mecca out there somewhere to say, here's the way to go, and it's not necessarily out there. But we'll continue that. It's about 10-2, and I want to give the two things. I want to give the public the opportunity, and I wanted to find out a little planning for the committee in the future. So are there any questions or comments from the public? I know we've got some members. Okay,
Hearing none, the only other issue I can see that I was thinking of for right now, we were talking about the property manager making some sort of presentation or having a similar dialogue with us. Is there any progress on that or your thoughts on that?
We can schedule something. I guess the question back to the commission, do you want it at the commission level, which probably makes more sense, or to keep it at the finance? So if you want to keep it at the commission, we'll look for a slot, work with the co-chairs on the agenda, openings, and try to work that in.
What's your thought on that? I mean, it could be analogous to this, or we could dedicate part of a commission meeting to it.
My initial take is we would not be a commission meeting.
What are the kinds of questions you want to address the property manager?
Well, you know, have we put together that list yet? You said you're developing.
Oh,
you have
assets?
Well, you said you had a whole bunch of data that you were asking the property manager to put together, and we haven't really seen that list yet.
Right. It's not finished yet. The three committees had different questions of the real property manager for requests for data, and so that's why I made the comment that you, as a commission, were interested in having the real property manager there. If not, I think we'd be fine to do it at the finance.
Well, it sounds to me like it's a little premature. So I, because what was going in the back of my mind, if we were going to, as a finance committee, meet next Thursday, that might be a good time to, but it doesn't sound like you're going to be ready. And what I'd like to do is have everybody take a look at that item to see if it warrants just the finance or the full commission.
Well, I quite agree with Lee that
keep it,
since we're trying to pick up the pace, that if it's in the finance committee, things come out there that are relevant to other committees, you can bring it up.
We'll bring it up.
The finance committee can bring it up at a commission meeting and touch the points that are relevant to others. But it looks like it's part of your inventory of the kinds of things that you want to put on the table if there's something that the property manager tells you that leads to possible alternatives to the school.
Yeah, and again, if anyone from the other committees want to go to that meeting, that's fine. I just want to avoid the possibility of us having a quorum. And we can always do this again.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the same for one.
Okay. Any other matters this morning for?
It's a similar matter, but it's like values. So actually, I brought that topic up as well on the planning commission, because there are a lot of projects that want to get, let's say, 3 or 4x the floor area ratio to build 3x amount that you can in residential property. It's kind of how we value it here, and that has tremendous impact on schools and facility. And so I've always asked for higher impact fees or values, what sort of values to make up for the fact that they're impacting the city. And the city attorney also says, no, no, you can't do that. The building charging system that we have right now, you cannot charge a higher impact fee, so do values. And I guess for me, we'll do this in that community, and people ask for a tremendous excess in square footage. Why can't we, or where's the mechanism? Maybe we can't, we haven't got the mechanism to actually offset the impact that large, like hybrid, we build a bunch of housing there, it's going to have a tremendous impact on South Hall of schools. And yet, we're trying to raise the impact fee, we're trying to develop this area, it's very, very difficult. That's a big pushback from the city attorney. Maybe explain what's the process.
We're not lawyers, so I think, it would be tough for us to advise on, obviously with impact fees, there has to be a nexus created of some kind. That's
about it. Nexus. You have
right.
A lot more single-family housing.
Right, yeah.
There may be a development agreement that precludes an additional impact.
No, these are
So, that's something we need to look at.
We have to sort of look at it case by case, I think. But it's fundamentally a legal issue, it sounds like.
I mean, it's something which, to me, makes sense if you have more impact on the facilities, whether it's building a school, park, whatever, and we should be more. I mean, it makes sense to me, but.
It's a legal and policy issue. Policy issue being the once you determine the nexus, the level of the impact, at what percentage are you recovering or charging for the impact?
Yes. And you do the city managing report, right? If you have a small house, we're losing money on it yearly. Every year, that's $300-$400. Right?
And that's, I guess, where I'm answering your question. The policy decisions, the council said, the impact fee
we lost the hotel, we lost all the tax, and we got all this $1,000 which costs. Why should it not be a better tax?
So we're approaching 9 o'clock here. I mean, I think these are good issues, whether we can resolve them today and where they belong. They certainly belong in the mix of discussion. So given that it's about 8:57, unless there's any objections, let's adjourn. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, we do.
Very good.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Well, I think that's what it's all about. It's not easy, is it?
Right. The commission meetings should have an agenda of business to begin with.